You're locked into Transmission Roundhouse. Hello and welcome to Queer Ear. I'm Rory Boyle and you are listening to the Transmission Roundhouse podcast that's queer thinking, straight talking and always spills the LGBT. On each episode, we like to shine a light on issues that don't get enough mainstream media attention. Now, we like to leave no gay stone unturned and no wig unsnatched on this podcast, which is usually all about having endless fun. But this episode is particularly serious, so I'm just going to give a quick content warning because we're going to be discussing issues such as racism, drug use and addiction, death, sexual violence, and mental health. If you'd rather listen to something a little bit lighter, all of our previous episodes are available via the Transmission Roundhouse website, and our Season 2 episodes are all available on Spotify, Apple, and everywhere you find podcasts.
A prominent Democratic donor is accused of running a drug den out of his Southern California home. Ed Buck is behind bars after his arrest overnight. Two men have died in his West Hollywood home from apparent overdoses since 2017. A third man survived an overdose last week. Buck is well known in Democratic Party circles and has donated to Hillary Clinton and other high-profile candidates.
Black and Latino queer people are being exploited by white gay men, whereby meth is used as the lure. And then once they lure particularly black men into their homes, meth is then used to control and sexually exploit people.
When you just take into account being a black person in America, you know, there's all these things that come with that. And then when you take into account being a gay person in the black community, you know, until recently, and even still now, we're not greatly accepted. You don't fully fit in with the black community. And then in the gay community, it's like, especially, you know, out here, racism is still very, very, very prevalent. So it's this whole other thing where it's like, oh, I don't fit in as a gay man. I don't fit in as a black person. I think that's one of the things. I wouldn't say it's the crux, but I think it's definitely a contributing factor.
This story first came to my attention when I read a three-part BuzzFeed News investigative series by BuzzFeed's LGBT editor Patrick Strudwick, which focused on the toxic combination of racism, sex, and meth being used to destroy queer people of color's lives. Now, I'm not looking to scaremonger or sensationalize Patrick's work in any way, but his piece is one of the most shocking things I've ever read. We just heard the voice of Tom Davis, a dancer, choreographer, HIV advocate, and recovering addict, who described how race has hugely played into these issues. He's been brutally honest about his time in these circles, likening his experience to slavery. We'll be hearing more from Tom later in the episode, as well as from activist and founder of gay men's group Impulse, Jose Ramos. But first, let's go back to Ed Buck. Two queer black men have been found dead in Buck's West Hollywood home since 2017 due to drug overdoses. Their names are Jamel Moore and Timothy Michael Dean. Many reports have indicated that Buck has a history of bringing queer men of color back to his house for meth and sex. I think what's nearly as hard for me to get my head around is the fact that it's taken a coalition of 50 civil rights organizations to get law enforcement to investigate this situation. Buck was finally arrested and charged with three counts of battery causing serious injury, administering methamphetamine, and maintaining a drug house. A federal charge was later added for one count of distribution of methamphetamine resulting in death. This was for the death of Jamel Moore. The death was originally deemed accidental by the coroner. Patrick Strudwick is one of the only people outside of the US to bring this story some mainstream attention. I wanted to find out what prompted him to report on this real-life nightmare that so many men of colour in LA are experiencing.
These sorts of allegations were swirling around for quite a while, so I thought I should go to Los Angeles and investigate. You know, what I sought to do was to hear from Black and Latino LGBT people in Southern California, hear their experiences. That process was not necessarily easy or simple. However, because I had been reporting on chemsex issues for several years, I had quite a few people who were willing to talk with me. Now, what they said when I arrived and I conducted many interviews was pretty horrific. I mean, really what was striking was how similar the experiences of people were. And it is really quite common for particularly richer, older, white gay men to use crystal meth to abuse Black and Latino queer people. Really what's happening is a kind of playing out of slavery culture, a playing out of slavery dynamics, in which colonial mindset is applied to Black people, dehumanizing. Men will entice Black men to their homes with meth, and when there, a whole dynamic will surface in which the white man's in charge, the white man has the power and control, and gets Black men to recruit other young, attractive Black men into their house to perform sexually for them, feeds everyone with lots of drugs, and does whatever they want. The result of that in the short term can be devastating. It can lead to loss of life. It can lead to sexual violence. Some of that abuse can be long term. In other words, there are people who will systematically over a long period abuse someone, feed them with lots of meth, feed their addiction, and enjoy watching their gradual degradation.
There is so much to unpack from what Patrick has just spoken about, and we'll hear more from Patrick later, but I want to go to Tom Davis now. He's somebody who's been deep in meth addiction and Ed Books circles. But more importantly, he's now on the road to recovery. But how does this happen to somebody in the first place? How do they end up in that downward spiral that Patrick just spoke of? To get a better understanding of some of these issues, I asked Tom to take me into his first experience using meth.
When I first did crystal meth, that was such a random experience. Like, it was some guy that I hooked up with. He just had it. I didn't even realize that it was meth, honestly. I figured it was cocaine. It was such a random one-off kind of thing. I don't know. After that, it just became a very progressive thing. You know, a few years later, another guy, he asked me when we were hooking up if I wanted to smoke. And, you know, that's what he had. So I did. And it just kind of became something that would happen every once in a while. I try to put a time and place on when I feel like it got to a place to where, I guess, like the point of no return. I honestly can't really put my finger on it. I think, you know, the one time where I do remember looking at myself in the mirror right after was I went over to this guy's place and, you know, we hooked up. And I had gone over there in the morning. And it was dark. And I remember just thinking to myself, how did that happen? You know, at the time, I kind of just laughed it off. And I was like, oh, my gosh. Like, I thought it was funny. A few years later, looking back at that experience, one of the things that I've always said about meth is that, you know, it's a drug for people that are really lonely. And that's the one thing I can say was the constant through all of that was I was dealing with a lot of feelings of abandonment, of loneliness, you know, feeling like I didn't have a place out here in LA. I was having a little bit of a difficult time transitioning, and somehow that drug kind of became like an outlet.
Is it something that you think is still happening all the time in these circles in LA? And if so, how many people do you think it's affecting?
Oh, God. Okay. So, yes, it is. It is happening every day, every night, every afternoon. It's been out of control, but it's so much more blatant now. It's really scary, honestly, when I think about it. And I try not to because, you know, I get anxious. If I had to put a number on it, whew, it's hundreds, thousands.
When I spoke to Tom, he was in downtown LA, and he volunteered to open up one of his apps to show me how many guys online were looking for meth and sex at that particular time.
If I'm looking at, like, my Jacked account, let me look at this right now so I can kind of give you an accurate number.
Sure.
But, you know, when I'm looking at this, you know, I get, like, what is it, 369? It pulls up, like, maybe 40 guys, yeah. Honestly, I would say if 40 guys are on and it is late at night, I would say at least 30 of them.
So hopefully that gives you some scope of the scale of this problem. That's just the number of men in his particular area that are engaging in this behavior. But the part that's really the most awful to me from Patrick's article and from some of the things that Tom has said is the violence and racism these men have experienced. They speak of torture, gang rape, guns to the head, intentional overdose by injection, enforced meth use, and systematic targeted abuse of individuals for months and even years. And as for the racism, they speak of it being ignited by meth, exploding into realms rarely discussed. Plantation slavery roleplay, sexual slavery with meth acting as a chain, a whip, a reward, and sexualized scattergun use of the N-word, all amid a culture drenched in the fetishization of black men. That is exactly how the experiences of Tom and many of the other men are described in Patrick's article. And he goes on to write that they describe black bodies as still being colonized in 21st century America, owned, beaten, and bought, with one image that manifests in multiple ways surfacing again and again. Slavery. I mean, I don't even know where to begin with that. So let's hear from Tom Davis again.
Yeah, that definitely was a part that made a lot of people gag. I think a lot of time people will think, oh, like, these white guys may be into me, or this, you know, older man may be into me, or it becomes a way for people to feel like they're being seen, and it becomes like an affirmation for them, even though they don't necessarily realize what's going on. Because that was the case with me. At first, you know, I felt like, oh, these people, like, they really, really like me. Like, I guess, like, I'm hot stuff. And then it's like, you know, taking a step back. All of these guys are white. Oh, all of them, you know, want to touch my hair. Oh, all of them talk about how beautiful my coloring is. People talk about, oh, you have just such a great speaking voice. You're so articulate. You know, things like that have taken me years to honestly be able to see that and recognize it and be like, okay, this comes from structural racism or oppression. It's not fun seeing things that way. It's not fun seeing white supremacy and how it manifests around you every day. That's one of the things that I always say sucks about working in public health or any kind of social justice field, is that when you wake up and when you start to see things, you know, you can't unsee it. I just think people aren't looking deeper into things and aren't looking at the interactions that they're having and really getting to the why, you know, because I think we get so caught up in just life and just everything else. And it's like, oh, well, I'm being seen by this person. Do I really want to analyze this? I feel seen right now, even if they just see me as a black dick or as a black ass or something like that. I'm seen. And yeah, it may not be in the best light, but being seen is better than not being seen at all.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I can totally understand that mindset. And I suppose one other thing that we should probably touch on is another major thing that's keeping a lot of people there is the fact that they're addicted to these drugs that they're being plied with. So it's sort of a lose-lose situation. Ed Buck is also facing charges. And finally, some light is being shone on this awful situation. Has that given you hope? Have things changed for you positively? And if so, how did you get out of that trap?
Yeah, things definitely, with the whole situation, are pretty much the same. I mean, it's great that Ed Buck's in jail and will be in jail for the rest of his life, but it doesn't bring Jamel back. It doesn't bring Timothy back. You know, even with that, it becomes this whole thing where it's like, oh, people may have been happy that Ed Buck was arrested, but they're still out here calling Jamel a prostitute. Mm-hmm. Or they're still out here calling Timothy a druggie. Like, honestly, I don't think anything has changed other than people are talking about it, I would say. Like, more of us that are living with addiction and trying to recover. Things for me, though, I mean, they go up and down, honestly. I still struggle to hang on to sobriety time. You know, when it gets to like that 2-3 month time, I feel like my spirit kind of just wants to give up a little bit. And it's just like, you know what, you made it this far, you made it 3 months, just go out for one night, clean it back up, and you know, you'll be fine. A lot of times it really does feel like I'm just not strong enough, you know. And even now, like, it's so hard for me to think about the rest of my life and to imagine myself never doing meth again, which is so bizarre. And I don't know why it's so hard for me to imagine that and believe that it's possible. I wish I could say things with me are completely different, but you know, honestly, I'm still in the same struggle.
But I think that it's really important that you are so open and honest about that, because we could sugarcoat things and say that everything's perfect. But I think it's kind of key to point out that it's not going to be an overnight process. So I like the fact that you are so vocal, and I'm really sorry for, you know, all the people that you've lost. I guess my last question to you is, how do people help? I think I'm finding it really frustrating that more people aren't talking about this. So how do we get the word out there and help people who are stuck in these situations?
What's helped me, honestly, is when I have people that check in on me constantly, even when I'm not a great person to talk to, and even when I blow them off and don't answer or return their calls. It's the consistency and knowing that somebody will keep on reaching out to make sure that you're okay. You know, it's been something that's, it's been hard for me to be able to accept from people, because it's like, why would you reach out to me still when I'm like going through this and been out, and you're still like calling me and you don't have anything bad to say, like, at all, really? And it's really hard. It's really, really, really hard to accept that, because it's almost like it reminds me of how loved I am. It's really, really hard for me to remember that all the time, honestly. You know, I can be a really hard person to love, and when people are consistent with reaching out to me, it makes me, you know, feel like I was proved wrong in the best way. What I would love to see is people asking more questions, just seeing where the person is in their journey with this, and not being judgmental or trying to find the silver lining. That almost makes me more angry than people being blatantly disrespectful, is when somebody is trying to find my silver lining. But yeah, I just wish people would see and want to see us where we really are. Nobody ever wants to delve deep if they have the emotional capacity to do it. You know, and if they're able to kind of, you know, go to that dark place with you and see where you are, it helps. It helps so much.
I have such admiration for Tom, because it can't be easy for him telling this story. And he's just expressed how much of a struggle it's been to stay on the right path. I think one thing that's really important to mention as well is that we shouldn't be centering whiteness at all in this story. But it's crystal clear that the perpetrators of this abuse are white. So what conversations should we be having around them? Patrick Strudwick again.
The white person here, whether that's me or whether that's Ed Buck or anyone else, is not the person who should be centralized in this discussion. Actually, the people who have been victimized are the people who should be centralized and focused upon. If there are discussions to be had about the experience of white people in all this, it is to begin a conversation which says, what is it about racism within white gay culture that persists? Why aren't we having a conversation with that? Why aren't people looking in the mirror? Why people who are already subject to homophobia are not smart enough or empathic enough to consider how their own prejudices play out to the horror of other people?
Do you think you've managed to find out the answer to that, or is that still something that you're searching for?
Well, I think it's not that complicated in some ways, in that people are racist and people are blind to that racism. And that's because racism is so entrenched in our culture. And by that, I mean British culture, American culture, lots of cultures. It's so entrenched that people don't even see it. The links between colonization of countries and of bodies and of human beings are really quite strong. If you keep telling yourself you just have a thing for black people, and that's fine, and that's not racist, but what that actually means is you prey on people's poverty and vulnerability and mental health problems by offering them a very dangerous drug, which you think that they might not be able to say no to, in order that you get your sexual kicks. You found racist instincts.
Patrick, the third part of the piece focuses on what happens when queer people of colour seek help for meth addiction. How much contact have you had with people that you spoke to since you've written this piece? And do you know if anything has changed in these circles in West Hollywood since this has been published?
Certainly, there has been a lot of conversations about all of this since then. And also, nothing has changed. Racists are still racist. Meth is still a huge problem. Sexual exploitation persists. Ed Buck is still awaiting trial. These are not simple, easy problems for which there are simple solutions. And what you have is a country without universal healthcare and extreme inequality. Those two things are real drivers in all this, along with racism itself. This isn't going to be sorted out quickly.
I think that has been made very clear from the piece, and it's a very unfortunate reality. But I'm hoping that maybe one positive thing that we can take away from your work is that you are shining a light on this issue. Do you think that we're going to see more work from you or from others in mainstream media about getting this message across?
Oh, there is more work being done on that front. I can't really go into details, but there are discussions around portraying some of these stories on TV. Also, you know, it's absolutely the case that I don't wish to platform my own work here, when actually the real work was done before I arrived on the scene, and that was by the local LGBT, Black and Latino activists and advocates and community workers who really raised the roof on this issue and really began speaking out on the street, on television, on social media. They are the ones that got attention to this. I merely did my job as a reporter, which is to document what people had been through.
I think it would be pretty irresponsible and wrong if we didn't signpost people struggling with some of these issues towards services available around the world. But I also think it's hugely important to quickly speak to one of the activists who fought against Ed Buck from the beginning, because Patrick's right, they really are the ones who've done the heavy lifting. Jose Ramos is one of those people. He is the founder of Impulse, a non-profit organization which hosts over 400 yearly events in 25 cities around the world, connecting gay men. Ed Buck's crimes hit close to home for Jose, not only emotionally, but also geographically.
I actually live in the street in which he lived, where the crimes happened, pretty close. So when it all happened, I really thought the community as a whole will come and show support. You know, it is two queer men. So for me, it was, how do we
keep asking for equality and awareness and, you know, all these things. But yeah, when the moment comes, we don't show up. Meth, it's not glamorous. And a lot of people don't want to associate themselves with a topic like that. And many of them thought, you know, that's what sex workers get. They kind of stigmatize their work, therefore didn't really care that much to show for their lives or what it means as a larger community.
That point about meth not being glamorous, do you think that the fact that this is happening in LA is maybe part of the problem? Because as we know, West Hollywood is full of actors and models and musicians, people who are very stereotypically concerned with their image. And I personally love LA, but it's also quite superficial to a certain degree. So is that adding to the issue?
Absolutely. You're 100% right. And yes, the city of West Hollywood, you know, it is what it is. We don't, as a gay culture, I don't think we want people to know our dirty laundry. I don't think we want people to know that we struggle with addiction or we struggle with meth. You know, there's nothing good about it, so it doesn't make us look good. So yes, because it is not glamorous, it's stigmatized so much, we don't want it to come out of the closet. We don't want people to know our dirty laundry. And hence, I think it has the power that it has. I do think we have the resources. We work closely with a couple of recovery centers in the city that are based for LGBTQ and meth use. So I do know for a fact there are services that include Latino, Black, and White. So I do think we have it. You know, a lot of the people don't really know that they have the problem, or, you know, there's a lot of people who believe they can be casual users, occasional users, until it's really late. A lot of the times, too, some people cannot afford it. You'll be surprised how expensive a rehab center is. If you don't have insurance, which a lot of these kids don't, it's really hard to get free resources. And it seems like it shouldn't be, but it is. And I can tell you that because I've tried to get friends in help, and I struggle to get them on help without insurance or without any money. So the services are there, but they're not equally available for everyone.
And you speak of your friends. You had three friends who either took their own lives or died due to meth. And that was all within the space of a year. And I'm sure you know many other people who have been really badly affected by some of these issues. How do you continue to go on when you've seen the amount of damage that's been done? How do you stop yourself from being so frustrated and angry and be part of the solution instead of, you know, just getting really, really frustrated at this situation?
Good question. I currently have two other people who are struggling, close friends of mine. This is like people that I hang out on a regular basis. I just joined a Meth Anonymous recovery meeting this Sunday for one of them who completed 3 years of sober. He's my oldest friend who 3 years ago, when he started his meth use, I said goodbye to him. He made it through. 3 years later, this weekend, I was very honored to give him a token, is what it's called when they, you know, complete birthdays. And for me, there's, to answer your question, there's still hope for people. And, you know, meth doesn't impact only certain people. It impacts all people. There are great people out there. They just struggle with mental health or addiction. But I do think that there's hope. So seeing my friend bounce back, being in a healthy relationship, hasn't used for 3 years, when at one point I thought he was not going to make it, gives me that energy to say, okay, even if it's one at a time, what I do and what we do as a community does help. And somebody has to do the work. I don't have the luxury to stop, to get fatigued, or to not care anymore. Because it is around me, it's around my friends, it's around the work that I do. So I don't have that luxury to just stop. And I also see that there's hope. There's people out there who are bouncing back. So I do think we can tackle this together as a community, if we allow it to come out and we talk about it freely.
I know that Impulse, which obviously you are so heavily involved with and have founded, they're, I suppose, a little bit non-traditional, not so medical, very sex positive. Tell us a little bit more about what Impulse actually does and how people can access their help.
What we do is we try to engage, connect, and support gay men. In all the major cities, we just really want to connect with them in a way that other ASOs or public health or the government is not doing so. The support, you know, the soul of what we do is depends on the city. In London, we have a team and they focus a lot around meth prevention and mental health. So that's what the community, the support, it will vary based on where you're at. But we're just about connecting them, bringing the information to them in a way that they want to listen to it.
Jose, a final question to you is about the pharmaceutical companies. Where do they come in on all of these issues around meth?
I don't think they come up much, to be honest. I don't see anything. At Buck Happen, it was only local people doing things. There's really no action. There's nothing evident for me to even recall and share something with you, which is a huge problem. I mean, I hear there's articles that come up that this is the second wave of the epidemic of opiates in the United States. It happened before and it's happening all over again. And there's really no conversation. It did start to impact more of the Y population, a little more affluent population. But I still don't see anything tangible being done.
You know, it's hard for me not to end this podcast on a positive note. I normally try to add humor or light into everything, but this topic is so heavy, and I think the message I want everyone to take away is that we need to stop being complacent, because this issue is affecting people in our community who have essentially been hidden in parts of society. And I think that we all need to stand up and make some noise and get involved and help, because everybody seems to have implied this isn't going away quickly and it's not going to be fixed easily. If you are facing any of these issues, please get in contact with your local crisis center. There are also some fantastic addiction and recovery services available online. We'll be putting all the details on our social media, which is at Queer Ear Podcast. If you want to find out more about Impulse as well, they're at Impulse United on Twitter and Instagram. I'm going to leave this story with one final quote from a woman called Kathy Watt. She is the executive director of the Van Ness Recovery House, the only LGBT residential rehab in LA that treats people regardless of their ability to pay. She says, "I could name 40 Ed Books. There's probably one condo in every apartment building in West Hollywood where this is happening." I asked Jose Ramos if he thought that was accurate, and while he couldn't 100% confirm anything, the answer was yes.
You're listening to Transmission Roundtable.